Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Today is Thursday, June 3rd.
Being together. And I think that.
Excuse me, as people are coming into the meeting, please turn off your microphone and turn off your camera. The committee has already started its business. Thank you. Before we begin the agenda, would you please call roll for the House and the Senate?
Senator Finley?
Senator Finley, present by video.
Senator Riley?
Present by video.
Senator Wagner? Senator Wagner?
We saw him. There must be an issue with the audio or the connection. We'll just say excused, but I expect him any moment because he was in the room.
Co-Vice Chair Boquist?
Excused, and we believe we're expecting him as well.
Co-Chair Burdick?
Excused, and we are expecting her any minute.
Representative Levy?
Present by audio.
Representative Marsh?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith is present by video.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama present by video.
Co-Vice Chair Pham?
Pham is present by video.
Co-Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke present by video.
Co-Chair Nathanson?
Nathanson present by video. Thank you for that. We have a number of items on our agenda. And before we begin our agenda, I want to let everyone who's with us and signed up to testify know that we will appreciate it if you keep your camera off and your microphone off until you're called on to testify. And many of you know already to please start by identifying yourself, your name, please. I will try to call at least a couple people in advance so that you can be prepared to testify. The way we're going to manage what looks like a very long agenda with a lot of hearings is I will be opening public hearings in some cases on two bills simultaneously when the content of the bill is the same subject. For example, on the printed agenda, the first two bills, a House bill and a Senate bill, are on the same topic. I will be opening a public hearing on both at the same time so that if someone was going to testify, you need to testify only once, not twice. There are basically seven bills or bill topics that we are hearing tonight. These are part of the core group of tax expenditures that already exist. So these bills are extending the sunset on existing tax expenditures. Before we start that, I would like our legislative revenue officer, Mr. Alanak, to give us an overview of the tax expenditures. I think maybe there's a table and also an update on the ARPA restrictions.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So I am going to share my screen here. And if you could let me know, is that coming through?
We see it.
Okay. So I just have a few pages here following up on questions from last week. And the first two pages here are what we refer to as kind of the tax expenditure budget or the initial estimates for extending the tax credits and all the bills that are in your committee. And they're organized by group. And this first group here are the core extenders. And there are eight policies in this list. The one that is missing from tonight is the IDA contributions. And that is because the committee does not yet have 2551. but simply extending these tax credits, and then there's one modification to the Working Family Dependent Care credit, collectively costs $52.3 million. And the original budget was around 53.6 for extending the full 11 credits that were on the schedule for this biennium. A few credits didn't make it through the process. So that subtotal is about $52 million. And those are the ones you're hearing tonight. And then tomorrow, you'll be hearing about Kyle will be going through the existing tax credits that have modifications. They're not part of, they're part of the cycle, but it wasn't their turn, so to speak, this time. And for a variety of reasons, there are proposed changes. And those have an estimated price tag of about $18 million. And then there are also four new tax expenditures, three credits and a subtraction, that collectively right now have a cost, an estimated cost of about $8 million. The one that is missing right here, the policy has a blank in it. And as the committee goes through each of these, Kyle's going to go into more detail about the policies involved. The idea here was just to provide that overall cost so you have some budget numbers in mind. And the total for this biennium is about $78 million, keeping in mind one of these is missing. So it's 80, you know, it's 78 million plus another amount for that one bill. And then it, I think as members are aware now, the cost generally doubles in the next two biennia, because in this biennium, they're getting extended in the middle of the biennium. This is basically an easy way to think about it is this is 1 year of cost, whereas for each of the next two biennia, it's a full biennial cost. So it's a 2 year cost. So that's the kind of number that was in question last week. So that's $78 million. The next page are the non-general fund impacts. And we haven't focused as much on those just yet. And for the most part, they're pretty small, although the total cost is around $30 million. And that's primarily the medical marijuana issue. And again, as we get, as the committee gets into those, you'll be hearing more from the economists about those details. Like the medical marijuana one is Mazin, so he'll be getting into some more detail about that one. But the intent here is just, here's what you have in your committee and the expected costs. So if there aren't any questions with that, I can go to the next page about the ARPA.
Yes, please do.
Okay. So here is, last week I provided some kind of hypothetical graphs and information about the ARPA restrictions. We've made some progress on going through the Treasury interim rule and have made some calculations. These are preliminary estimates. I'm still touching base with some other stakeholders and getting some review of the estimates. But the basic situation here within the guidelines, as I described last week, is there is this, what we call a counterfactual baseline, and that's this blue line number. And the base year is fiscal year 19, and you take that amount of state tax collections, and this is broader than just the general fund, and you take that amount and you grow it by inflation throughout the covered period, which is through the end of 2024. And that sets this kind of expectation for when it's a threshold really for what we want to watch in terms of any tax cuts that the legislature may enact. So that's the blue line. This orange line is the current revenue forecast. And where we get into this area of fiscal year 23, 24, and 25, with the forecast being above that baseline, that's basically indicating that there's room, some amount of room to cut taxes that will not be deemed to be paid for with federal ARPA money. They would be deemed to be paid for through natural organic growth is the term that they use. So this counterfactual baseline and the fiscal year 19 figure I've taken from published census data off their website, and that just grows forward. The rule also has a de minimis amount, which is basically 1% of that baseline. And so the key thing to think to notice here is when we get into the next few years, this de minimis amount is give or take $150 million. And the rule says that if net tax revenue reductions are less than the de minimis amount, then there's really no problem. You just, there's nothing to see here. We're below that de minimis and no problem. The collections forecast is presented here. And then this last line is how much room there is between the orange line and the blue line. And the closest we get is fiscal year 22. We're $296 million above that baseline forecast. So that means there's only about $300 million that the legislature could cut taxes in that year and not run the potential risk of having Treasury say that there needs to be a clawback. In subsequent years, we have a good bit of room, and I think that makes intuitive sense. And as some members noted last week, fiscal year 19 was before the CAT came in place, and that's the biggest contributor here. And that came into play fiscal year 20, and so that's embedded in these forecasts. So it looks like we have a fair amount of room. I am still calling these preliminary estimates, just touching base with other stakeholders about interpretation of the rule. And I won't go into all of the footnotes, but there are a lot of decisions are made in coming up with these estimates.
Thank you, Mr. Alanak. And the committee will certainly have an opportunity at another meeting after we've had all of these important public hearings. We will have an opportunity at other meetings to discuss the implications of this and how it might affect our work. Senator Finley, I saw your hand go up quite a while ago. I apologize that I didn't get to it right away. It's your turn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, I just had a question back on chart one. When I look at that, I see tax credits that we approved in our last cycle that aren't on here. And that's because of the sunset was out probably 6 years away, I assume. But they don't, an example that comes to mind is the Shoreline Railroad tax credit. That's not listed on here. And I wonder, is it because it's already funded in the with the sunset?
Senator Finley, that's correct. This is not all of the tax credits that exist in the state. So all of the ones that you extended last time are already embedded in the revenue forecast that you have. So putting a line on it, so everything that you extended in 2019 is already included in this orange line.
Okay.
So these are just decision points for you right now.
I assume that to be, I just needed to clarify. Yep. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Committee members, any other questions before we move to the public hearings? I'll wait a few seconds. I'm not seeing any hands yet. I think the signal is it's okay to move to our public hearings. Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2444 and Senate Bill 142. LRO.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, House Bill 2444 and Senate Bill 142 are a tax credit extension or are tax credit extension bills. In this case, it's relating to the tax credit available to taxpayers with a qualifying disabled child. So the credit itself is, it's an additional personal exemption credit. So what that means is it's a credit that it's indexed to inflation. In tax year 2021, it'd be worth $214 as an income tax credit. And it's available, again, to those taxpayers that have a child that's meeting the definition of disabled child for purposes of the credit. In the most recent years, we've had about 20,000 taxpayers have been claiming this for an average reduction or an average credit amount of about $200. In terms of going forward, and this is in keeping with the chart that Chris just showed, we're expecting the cost to be about $5 million per year. In terms of what's available in OLIS, this goes for all the credits you'll be hearing tonight as well. is we do have the tax credit report that LRO prepares related to the credits that are up for their sunset review. So that's all the credits you have up today. So that's in the meeting materials, the full report. And then additionally, under each individual bill, there's the excerpt of that tax credit report specific to the bills in question and the credit that they're covering. So that's just to make you aware of some material that is available in OLS as well to provide background and analysis related to these credits. But again, this is the 6-year sunset extension of the Child with a Disability tax credit.
Thank you. From what I can tell, we have no one signed up to testify on either of these bills. Will LRO please confirm that we have no one signed up for the public hearing?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you for confirming that. Committee members, any questions for Mr. Easton about this tax credit? Anything before I close the public hearing? Okay, I'm closing the public hearing then on House Bill 2444 and Senate Bill 142. Next, I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 143. There are several people signed up to testify, so we will call on you in just a moment after we've had our introduction from Legislative Revenue Office.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 143, this is the tax credit relating to rural medical care. This is for rural medical providers, and I do have just a few slides for you that I'll try to go through very briefly to try to set up the discussion here related to the rural medical providers credit. But again, this is available in OLS, and there's a few of the credits that do have more specific presentations with a few slides. But again, these are based upon the information that was shared with the policy committees as well. If you'll bear with me for one second, I'll get that shared here.
Thank you. And while Mr. Easton is preparing that, I should have told you before, the reason I skipped over a couple of bills, because we have people waiting in the room to testify, I would like to take those bills first where people are waiting to testify. And that's why I skipped a couple where no one is signed up. And we'll get back to those later. Just trying to be considerate of the members of the public who are waiting.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, yes, as I was saying, this is the Rural Medical Providers Tax Credit. Let's get rid of slide two. It was enacted back in 1989, and the original policy purpose of this credit was related to, it was a combination of retention and recruitment of certain medical providers into rural areas. There have been changes recently made to the credit or in recent legislative sessions, and part of that has reflected a shift in somewhat of the purpose going from a retention and recruitment to AIM being the primary purpose really related to retention, with recruitment being maybe a secondary effect of the credit. In terms of what is this credit, it's a credit that's available, again, to rural medical providers. These are in statute, the definitions related to physicians, dentists, podiatrists, and the list goes on. It's here at the bottom of the slide here. But the credit itself is, the value of the credit is between $3,000 and $5,000, and it's a function of how far the medical provider, where they're providing medical care, is from what's considered an urban area, or that's how it's determined to be they're providing care in a rural area, is distance from a community with a population of 40,000 or more. So the further you are from one of those larger population centers, the potentially greater amount of the credit you can get. And again, that's listed here in the table you have here, that the credit begins at $3,000. Once you get 50 or more miles from one of those urban areas, it goes up to the value of $5,000. So it's either $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000. And there are all other requirements as well, providing care in the rural areas related to hours and such. In terms of the sunset that we have right now in place, there is a grandfather clause. So this is really a sunset based upon new entrants into the program. So for the credit or the sunset that you're extending here would be the sunset of new entrants into the program. So by extending that sunset, you allow new physicians in rural areas to come into the program. But the grandfather clause is set up where if this credit is allowed to sunset, there still could be continued use of this credit by existing rural medical providers that are qualifying for the credit previously. And that's reflected in the revenue impact statement of why the use of this credit and the cost of extending it aren't necessarily the same. And that is because of the grandfather clause. In terms here, this is just a map showing you where are these rural areas. Again, anything outside of these yellowish circles are considered rural areas. So they can qualify for at least that 3,000, but up to that 5,000 amount of the credit. There have been some recent changes, and this is what the paper goes into a bit, our tax credit report, is some of these recent changes and whether or not we've detected an effect in the credit from the recent changes. But two of the changes have been modifying the credit amount. So it used to be a flat $5,000. And beginning with tax year 2016, that was adjusted to that $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 amount. And then more recently, beginning in tax year 2018, there was a limitation put in place for taxpayers with an adjusted gross income greater than $300,000. So there was a means testing applied to the credit with an exception for surgeons and one other class of physicians as well. But so that's what we spend our time in the paper, and I won't go into too much detail here, but is looking at, well, with these recent changes that occurred with the credit, can we see any impact on the numbers taking the credit or those that are being certified or also the licensed people that are physicians that are being licensed in these rural areas? And that's what we go into in the paper. And I just have a couple charts here to take a look at that. And you definitely can see the impact of the AGI limit at 300,000 as that limits people's ability to qualify above that means tested limit. And we can see that beginning in 2018 where we did see use the credit drop. And you can see that is predominantly going to be in the medical doctor for the type of rural physicians or the rural medical providers that are affected by that 300,000 AGI limit. Because we did see that drop by medical doctors, where in some of the other categories, nurse practitioners and such, we continue to see growth or maybe a little bit of a flatter growth, but still year over year growth in many of those other categories. And then finally, we did want to take a look at the number of license renewals for medical professionals in these rural areas to get a sense of, well, by changing the credit to a 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000 amount, did we see a decrease in the number of medical providers that are re-upping their license? And this information, it's very preliminary. We're only a couple years into the change. And it's really more set up as this is something we'll be continuing to look at going forward to see if we can see a difference where, because the credit has been lower, the amount of the credit, do we see fewer medical providers re-upping their licenses in later years? And of course, there can be a lot of things that go into this, the age of the population, the medical providers and such. But again, it was just drawing your attention to some work that is in the paper and something that we'll be continuing to look at as well going forward to see if we can see any changes in this rural medical provider community resulting from changes to the credit.
Thank you, Mr. Easton. Representative Rushke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Easton, what's the usage rate on this? So there's it's means tested at $300,000 or less is the average income or their at their income level. How many providers can take advantage of this, and then how many do take advantage of it?
Yeah, Representative Rushke, I'm looking at my notes here to see, because again, this credit is not, it's not a refundable credit, and it's not a credit that can be carried forward. Checking my notes here, I think I do have some information in the paper where the use of the credit is not the full $5,000 amount, because again, you do need sufficient tax liability to be able to claim this.
Right. My question is just basically about the participation rate. So if you have a universe of 100% of physicians and healthcare providers that can take advantage of it, how many are, I get? I'm trying to find the percentage of those who take advantage of it.
Yeah, Representative Rushke, that's not something, I don't have numbers on that in front of me of looking for those that qualify If they qualify, I'm not sure what would stop them from taking it so long as they're meeting the qualification requirements. The Office of Rural Health, I know their website, and they do a good job of outreach and then following up with individuals each year to get them to reapply as well. So I think once they're made aware of the program, it definitely, I think they're continually made aware of it, or they're notified each year as well.
Thank you.
Thanks. Anything else for Mr. Easton or LRO before we move to the witness list? We have a number of people signed up to testify tonight. The names, the first three names I will call are Robert Dumick, Sam Barber, and Katie Kling. So in that order, please, Robert Dumick.
Yeah, good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Dumick. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and we administer the provider tax credit. So thank you for your time this evening. Representative, I don't have the percentage of providers taking advantage at this time with me, but I will look into that and get that information back to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The provider tax credit is one of the many tools that we use in our toolbox to recruit providers and retain the providers in our rural communities. As many of you know, it is difficult sometimes to get those providers into our rural communities. And everything we can do to get them out there and keep them is really, really vital. We have loan repayment and loan forgiveness as some of the tools that we use to get providers, once they become eligible providers after school, into those communities. But what we don't have always is that long-term sort of commitment that keeps them out there. The tax credit allows us to pull them out just a little bit longer. They get very well established. And then we have a much better success rate at retaining those providers in those communities. And I won't go into all of the details and numbers that Mr. Easton did today, but I would add that, you know, the pandemic has created a rather difficult situation for our healthcare providers across the state. And while we don't have the full impact of that at this time, we do expect there to be a large number of retirements coming up, and that we will struggle as we look to replace those providers and to keep our staffing high in the rural communities. So this is a really important tool for us to utilize. And so I would encourage the committee to support. And I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll hear from Sam Barber.
Hi, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sam Barber, here on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association, in strong support of Senate Bill 143 and extending the sunset on the Rural Medical Provider Tax Credit. The Rural Health Association represents both individuals and a long list of healthcare organizations. And we do so to advocate for access to high quality, affordable healthcare for rural Oregonians. I first want to point you to the testimony I submitted on OLIS for today's hearing. You will see over 30 professional organizations, hospitals, independent clinics, and nonprofits in support of extending this credit. The Rural Health Association has worked with the legislature over the last decade to make the credit as efficient and effective as possible. As Mr. Easton noted, the legislature has made a number of changes to the tax credit over this time period. The last three times it has come up for renewal, in fact. In order to maximize the impact of the credit for the least cost to the state. In 2013, Medicare and Medicaid service requirements were added in order to improve access for those patient populations. And in 2017, the legislature added a $300,000 income tax or income cap to the credit, with exemptions for providers who deliver babies and for general surgeons. You also added a 10-year lifetime limit to the credit. And those two changes were added to address two perceived weaknesses. One, that specialists making larger salaries and providers that have remained in rural areas for a long time were no longer incentivized by the credit. So, you know, we think that those are reasonable and smart changes that have been made to the credit. We are supportive of the credit in its current form. Provider recruitment and retention are complex, and it is difficult to attribute any single factor as the reason a person might practice in a rural community. Decisions to practice are made based on many factors, including total compensation and financial incentives, but also things like the quality of schools for their children, job prospects for their partner, is the community a good fit, and countless others. But what I can tell you is that the state funded a third-party evaluation of this credit, as well as the other provider incentive programs we have in Oregon. And that report, known as the Lewin Report, told us that the combination of incentives used in Oregon works, and this credit in particular has a significant retention effect. So with that, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Next on the witness list is a name, Katie Kling, but I bet it's Katie King. So whichever one of you is here, please step forward.
Thank you very much, Chair Nathanson and Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Kling, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Oregon ASEP strongly supports Senate Bill 143. Recruiting board-certified physicians to rural areas is exceedingly difficult, and they often earn up to 20% less than their colleagues in urban areas. The tax credit's considered a good incentive, and it's used for recruitment purposes for hospitals. We'd also like to request that emergency physicians be added to the list of physicians that receive an exemption to the gross income eligibility cap of $300,000. So OBGYNs and rural surgeons receive that now. The emergency department's an important part of the safety net, especially in rural areas. Having access to board-certified emergency physicians is just as important as having access to other specialists. At some rural hospitals, emergency physicians might exceed the income cap in statute, but they're also working long, busy shifts, nights, weekends, and holidays, and it's been especially frenetic during the pandemic. And in some cases, it's the only way that hospitals can even, emergency departments can even stay open in rural areas of the state. Also, when you consider that the average medical school debt is over $225,000, which severely limits the ability of young physicians to start families and buy homes while taking a pay cut to work in rural areas. High student debt incurred during the 10 years of training, not to mention the loss of income during this period, is considered common. In the rural, provider tax credit is one great tool to support physicians who choose to practice in rural areas, and it also supports the health of communities as well. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question's for any of the three that just testified. And as the cost of living has increased, and we just heard the cost of training to become a medical professional has significantly increased, has this credit kept up with those costs? And is it still an effective tool, or does it need to be looked at again, maybe in the near future, to do what it's designed to do, to attract providers to rural Oregon? Thank you.
Chair Nathanson and Representative Reschke, I'll defer on that question, but I could just say anecdotally for emergency physicians, this rural provider tax credit is really important. And I think that it does make a difference. Thank you.
Any comment from Mr. Barber or Dumink?
Madam Chair and Representative, I would say that the tax credit has pretty much remained the same since it was first created. And there are those that would say that it should be increased in order to meet the increasing costs, et cetera. We're also sensitive of the fact that we have to work with larger state budgets when we make these requests. So future review, my opinion is we should always be reviewing all of our programs, which I think is why our tax credits come up for review now on a regular basis. And in future years, I wouldn't be opposed to that conversation, but understand the challenges that go with it.
This is Sam Barber again with the Rural Health Association. I would just add that in the past, we've looked at a number of ways of expanding the tax credit. And I think from the Rural Health Association's standpoint, there are other ways of expanding the credit other than increasing the award amount that we would recommend first before we expand it in that way. And for example, there's one, there's some kind of arbitrary hospital criteria that excludes certain providers that work at certain hospitals that would otherwise be considered rural. And so that's just one example of the type of thing we would like to add back if we were given that opportunity.
Thanks for the response. Next, let's hear from Dan Cushing. I also have two other names, and if they are not here, I still, for the public record, would like to call their names. Dan Cushing, Bart Bruins, and David Rickman.
Good evening, Chair Nathanson, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Dan Cushing, and I'm here today representing Douglas County Independent Physicians Association, and we are here in strong support of Senate Bill 143. The physicians of Douglas County have asked me to share with you tonight that they have found this credit to be an extremely valuable tool in bringing doctors to our county and keeping them here. Like many other rural areas in Oregon, we sometimes struggle to attain local services from many physician specialties, such as cardiologists, emergency room doctors, as Ms. King mentioned, pulmonologists, oncologists, dermatologists, gastroenterologists, and orthopedic surgeons, just to name a handful there. Traveling 60 to 90 minutes for this type of care can be very difficult and should not be necessary, especially for our low income and elderly members in our community. We greatly hope for the renewal of this credit, and we would welcome future opportunities to improve and expand it, perhaps by eliminating some of the income caps for certain specialists, as has been suggested. I will refer you to a letter in OLIS from Dr. Bart Bruns for more information on that, and I thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are Mr. Bruns or Dr. Bruns or Dr. Rickman with us tonight? It appears they are not able to join us tonight. LRO, does that complete our list of people who have registered for Senate bills?
Chair, this is Rep. Levy, and I don't know how to raise my hand, but I have a question.
Great. Yes, please go ahead.
And so it's to anybody who can answer it. So in my area, in my district 58, we just had a 16-bed psychiatric care hospital shut down because they could not get qualified psychiatrists in and couldn't get them to stay. So does this incentive cover them, or do we have another incentive type of thing that would help bring them to our area? Because I know that mental health across the state is up considerably in just about everybody's district. But I'd like an answer to that if anybody's got that.
I'm going to call on Mr. Dumig to give a response.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, mental behavioral health is such a huge issue across the state, and one that we continue to struggle with. We do have a new behavioral health loan repayment program that we have started in our office with under an agreement with the health authority and the workforce committee that is focusing on mental and behavioral health workers who are working their way through school. So it's a loan repayment program, and our goal is to get about $2 million out the door here in the coming months to help support those providers. I don't have all the details of the workings that are going on right now with the legislation that's working its way through the process. It's going to focus on mental and behavioral health, but I do know there's some additional support in that legislation as well that will go toward provider incentive. I agree with you that it is a huge issue and needs continued attention.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rep. Levy, for raising that, and Mr. Dumick for responding. Any other questions? And would LRO confirm that no one else signed up?
Yes, Madam Chair, no one else has signed up.
Okay, that completes our list of witnesses for Senate Bill 143. I'll wait just a few more seconds. 4, 5. I don't see any more hands. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 143. The next bill that has people signed up to testify is House Bill 2441. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2441.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2441 is a tax credit related to the University Venture Development Fund. And so this is a credit that's really designed to be to incentivize contributions to these public university venture development funds. And there are a number of slides in OLIS as well on this one. And I would share my screen just to show you a couple, because this credit does work a little bit different than your traditional credit. And there is a flow chart that I'll share with you all that helps to explain exactly how this credit works, as it does have what's somewhat unique about this credit is it has a repayment system back to the general fund as well. So in terms of the university or the credit for the University Venture Development Fund, again, this credit is intended to incentivize taxpayers to make contributions to these university venture development funds. And it does that by providing a tax credit equal to 60% of the taxpayers' contribution to these venture development funds. And these university venture development funds are used to support the commercialization of university research and development. So that those are things that are ongoing at the university, and these funds are then used to support that commercialization of those that research. And I believe you'll have some testimony on some of these examples of these types of projects as well coming. But what I would show you here is there is a chart related to the flow of how this credit works. So again, the taxpayer makes these contributions to one of the university venture development funds. This could be with the University of Oregon, Oregon State, Portland State University, or the Oregon Health and Sciences University. They all have these funds set up. But so the taxpayer makes a contribution to a university venture development fund, and the taxpayer would receive a credit equal to 60% of that contribution amount. The University Venture Development Fund then distributes those funds per their venture grant program. So that's the commercialization of university research. After that's done, so after those UVDF grants are distributed, years down the road, the goal is that this commercialization, these projects that are successful, will then make repayments back to the UVDF. And from there, as the university is earning royalties and such from these projects, 20% of those realized gains are then transferred back to the general fund. And so then by transferring those amounts back to the general fund, the universities earn room under the credit limit to begin issuing more credits going forward. So there is an overall limit on the credit, and that's on the next slide. And this is tied to the individual universities. But the takeaway here is really the universities, there is a flow here. So if a university is creeping up against its limit, then as those repayments are made, they can then reissue more credits going forward. And that's what we've started to see. There is more information in the paper, but University of Oregon has had some success in this. And then going forward, some of the other universities as well, before they'll be able to reissue more of these credits, they will have to begin making repayments in some cases back to the general fund. And that impacts why you see the revenue impact is lower than the credit caps that you see in this slide here. But again, just wanted to bring it to your attention of the sort of the flow of funds of this credit, but it really is a credit meant to induce contributions or work as a funding source for these university venture development funds.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Easton? I don't see any. Yes, Rep. Rushkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Easton, on slide 7 there, it talked about credit limit by institution, and I see millions of dollars in the left-hand column and $7,500 for those in the, kind of the right-hand column. Maybe you explained it, but I didn't understand it. So I ask you explain it again, maybe why the discrepancy there.
Yeah, Representative Rushkey, I believe it's just tailored at the university, the larger universities on where they felt these UVDF funds would be most used. Because yes, the smaller universities did receive that $7,500 limit.
Thank you.
We have 3 people signed up to testify. The names are Chuck Williams, Connor Barth, and Juan Barraza. Mr. Chuck Williams first.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chuck Williams. I'm the Associate Vice President for Innovation at the University of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2441 and the University Venture Development Fund. I'm here today to ask the committee to extend the sunset date of the UVDF and allow the universities to continue this essential program. Since the launch of the UVDF tax credit in 2007, the universities have worked in partnership with our affiliated foundations to raise funds in support of this program. Promising ideas are abundant at Oregon's universities. We have world-class faculty researchers and incredibly innovative students. The significant challenge all universities face is transforming those ideas through additional focused research, development, proof of concept, and scale-up, while in parallel aligning them to a market need. Prior to the UVDF and continuing today, there is simply no state funding and little federal funding available to support the technological development and the early stage innovation training programs necessary to move these promising ideas forward. The UVDF program is filling that void, allowing us to bridge what is commonly called the Valley of Death. Risk adversity in the private sector increasingly requires us to carry the development of promising ideas further, and often through company formation. The path from identifying a promising technology-based idea to an initial product or service takes an average of 8 to 12 years. And while the Knight campus at the University of Oregon is working to accelerate the timeline for these deep tech opportunities, we also need to recognize that the path itself significantly contributes to the culture of innovation in our universities, and we increasingly see more faculty and students that want to see the impact of their research through participation and utilization in the private sector. For example, over 7,000 students at our universities have received training, participated in programs and competitions, worked as interns, or launched companies themselves. These students are receiving highly experiential training and mentoring that contribute to the success of Oregon companies hiring our graduates. The UVDF is a key economic development tool for the state. The research university's collective efforts have led to the launch of over 100 new companies, and those companies have raised over $150 million in funding, provide in excess of 350 jobs, and have now launched over 20 products. These are high-growth, traded sector companies. There are a number of letters of support from these companies uploaded on OLIS, and the logos of the most recent spin-off companies. You may notice a few companies in recent press releases, including Defunkify, InVivo Biosystems, Kasana Health, Impria, Valiscore, Agility Robotics, Inherent Targeting, Promedics, PDX Pharma, Diatomics, Stone Stable, and many more in the pipeline. The UVDF tax credit is unique in that it offers the ability to become evergreen for the state. In 2007, Oregon initially authorized $8.4 million in total tax credit authority for this program. And through the success of primarily Oregon-based companies, the universities are returning revenues back to the state. I'm here to simply ask for a 6-year extension of the tax credit program. No new tax credit authority is being requested. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Next is Connor Barth.
Co-chairs Nathanson and Burdick and members of the committee, I'm Connor Barth, Senior Research Associate in the Biomedical Engineering Department at Oregon Health and Science University and co-founder and CEO of Inherent Targeting, which is a startup biotech company we've developed based on technologies from our lab. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story with you today. Support through the UVDF has been instrumental in helping me take a promising early stage research concept developed in our laboratory and move it forward into commercialization and clinical translation via startup company. For background, we're focused on development of novel fluorescence imaging technologies, largely applied to cancer imaging. We're particularly interested in the idea of fluorescence-guided surgery, which could be described as cut by color or paint by number for surgeons. Fluorescence-guided surgery has found significant acceptance in the oncological surgery space due to the challenge of diseased tissue removal while sparing as much as normal tissue as possible for the patient. We developed nerve-specific probes that can be used with the clinical fluorescence-guided surgery systems. And this novel technology is the only method to directly visualize nerve tissue in the operating room. It's an exciting development because it will help surgeons avoid damaging nerves during surgery. And nerve damage is a common problem in many surgical situations that can leave patients with loss of function, chronic pain, and general disability. UVDF provided us funding to evaluate the preclinical pharmacology and toxicology profiles of our lead nerve-specific compounds, which are necessary steps in the clinical translation pipeline that are not traditionally funded by existing mechanisms. Due to the commercial potential of our nerve-specific probe technology that we realized and evaluated the preclinical profiles, we're able to spin out our startup company, Inherent Targeting, where my lab advisor, Summer Gibbs, colleague and postdoc in the lab, Lei Wong, and I are co-founders. UVDF funding helped us leverage both the technology and necessary preclinical safety profiles in order to access additional grant funding through the Murdoch Commercialization Program, and has culminated to date with recent business grant funding and investor support from the National Institute of Health, Business Oregon, and SciFounder, bringing $2.7 million into our Oregon startup. The recent business grant funding to Inherent Targeting has allowed me to dedicate my full time and attention to the startup and for us to hire our first employees. Inherent Targeting, which is currently located at the startup incubator, Oregon Bioscience Incubator, is in its infancy, but the company has a strong foundation and great potential to translate contrast agents to the clinic and improve surgical medicine and grow into a thriving Oregon company. We're excited about the future of this technology and our ability to translate the nerve-specific probes to the clinic to guide surgery. None of this would have been possible without the critical early stage funding that the UVDF provided, provides promising research ideas. I urge you to support HB241 and the University of Venture Development Fund. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for being with us tonight. And finally, Juan Barraza.
Co-chairs Burdick and Nathanson, my name is co-vice chairs Boquist and Pham. For the record, my name is Juan Barraza. I'm the director of student innovation at the Portland State University Center for Entrepreneurship. I'm here to ask today for your support of HB 2441, the University Venture Development Fund. The University Venture Development Fund has led the support to support the programs like the PSU CleanTech Challenge and Invent Oregon. UVDF has provided support for Oregon inventors and entrepreneurs to develop solutions to problems that affect Oregonians and our communities across the state. Past and current participants of the program have developed and taken the steps to commercialize their inventions, ranging from new forms of vertical farming, new network sensors for early detection of devastating forest fires like the ones we experienced and endured in 2020, new ways to harvest wind and solar energy to create a new form of electrical grid, and new recyclable materials to manufacture in real-time products across Oregon. Many of these concepts are creating new businesses across Oregon, from Klamath Falls to Coos Bay to the Willamette Valley. Your support to HB 2441, University Venture Development Fund, will help fuel the next generation of Oregon inventors and entrepreneurs across the state. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
And thank you as well for being with us tonight. LRO, I want to confirm, does that complete our list of people signed up to testify?
Madam Chair Nathanson, yes, it does.
Thank you. And I do see someone has a question. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Really quick question for our staff. To me, it seems like these investments are valuable for the state of Oregon. Is there any form of mechanism that contractually obligates these folks to remain in Oregon? Or are they able to take advantage of these investments and move to other states that may have different tax structures that may better benefit them for whatever their project may be?
Yeah, Representative Smith, I'm not aware of any limitation. The universities may be able to speak more to the projects that they fund and how that works, but I don't know of any limitation in statute that says after you start this project, you start this business years down the road, you can't then move to another state or expand operations or locations in another state or anything like that.
Well, and thank you. I really appreciate that. I guess the reason I raised that issue is it seems as if the state of Oregon is going to be the mother hen that helps companies get out of the nest, and maybe once in a while we'd want them to stay close to the nest or return back to the nest. And so just a thought, nothing to stop my support of this initiative, but just something perhaps to think about in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Rep. Smith. I see that Mr. Williams wants to respond. I'm going to allow a very brief response, and I want to do a time check with the committee. We have a few more bills to go and a half hour remaining. Mr. Williams, do you have a brief response to that question?
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson and Representative Smith. There actually is in statute a requirement that when we provide UVDF funds to our spin-out companies, they must remain in Oregon for at least 5 years. Or they must repay the entire amount that we give to them.
That's, Madam Chair, that's pretty darn good. Thank you. And I really appreciate that explanation.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very glad that you were able to provide that for us tonight. That completes our list of witnesses. I see no other hands. So thank you again to Mr. Williams, Mr. Barth, and Mr. Barasa for your testimony. I am closing the public hearing now on House Bill 2441. The next bill with people signed up to testify appears to be Senate Bill 149. So I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 149.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 149, again, this is a tax credit extension bill. In this case, this is relating to a credit available, it's a corporate credit that's available to insurance companies related to assessments paid to the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. The acronym for that is OHIGA, but what the credit does is it provides a credit, again, it's a corporate credit, for insurers that are incurring a qualified assessment. And these are assessments that are used to cover the cost of claims against insurers that have become insolvent. So to give an example, an insurer becomes insolvent and then the remaining insurers have this OHIGA assessment levied against them in which that they can then claim a credit for that assessment amount. And the credit in this case is equal to 20% of the assessment taken over each of the 5 years. So it's 20% each year taken over 5 years. So it can sum up if the insurer has sufficient tax liability, 20% in each of the 5 years, it can sum up to potentially 100% of that assessment amount. But again, these assessments are to cover claims of insurer that does become insolvent. In terms of giving you some information that's contained in the revenue impact statement as well, when we look at historically, this is a fairly rare occurrence. Occasionally will have an insolvency, then this credit, these assessments will be levied, and this credit will be claimed for up to those 5 years following those individual assessments. We did most recently Penn Treaty Network of America was placed in liquidation back in March of 2017. So we have seen some of these assessments been levied in the most recent years. And for that reason, we do expect credit use in the coming years. But in many ways, this credit will occasionally go down to zero for a number of years and then get used for a number of years. So on an average amount, you can see what we expect the impact to be going forward right now under the present conditions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Easton before we move to our list of witnesses? Just a moment, I see a hand going up. And by the way, I would like to welcome Senators Burdick and Boquist, who have joined the meeting. They've been with us for a while. We know that there was a little bit of a problem getting signed in when we were first taking the roll call, but welcome to the meeting. I'm trying to get down to the area to see who's got a hand up.
It's Senator Riley that has a hand.
Thank you, Senator Riley.
Thank you. So the instance that we had in 2017, I believe you said, with a insolvency, and this was used in that case, but the people who were insured didn't get anywhere near what they were insured for, and in fact, it was almost laughable, in my opinion, the little that they got compared to what they had would have gotten had the company not gone insolvent. Do you remember that, Kyle?
Senator Riley, I don't have any information on the amount of the assessment. My focus was mostly on the credit. I don't want to put anyone on the spot. I know we have individuals from DCBS that may be able to speak to that, but I don't know that for sure.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Sure.
We did have witnesses at that time who brought evidence that they actually got less than 10% of what they would have gotten for their claim had the company not been insolvent. So I just wanted to bring that out, that it's not that this is not a good thing. It's just nowhere near sufficient for the people who have claims.
Thank you, Senator Riley, for noting that. I'm calling the list of witnesses now who've signed up. I'll let you know all five names in advance. T.K. Keene, Greg Lathrop, Ryan Chifo, Bennett Minton, and John Mangan. So, first, T.K. Keene.
Yeah, good evening, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is T.K. Keene, and I'm the administrator with the Division of Financial Regulation. I'm joined here by Greg Lathrop, who is our manager of insurance institutions and has a lot of touch points with our Guarantee Association, which is a separate entity. And we are happy to help the committee with any of the technical questions that may come up but do not have. We have no position on the bill and just want to be available to you all as a resource.
Thank you for noting that for us. So I'll skip over Mr. Lathrop also for now and note that you are available. Next, Ryan Chifo.
Thank you very much. Chair Nathanson, Burdick, Vice Chairs Boquist, Pham and Reschke, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Chifo. I'm the Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for the Standard, which is Oregon's largest domestic life insurer and an Oregon insurer for over 115 years. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in favor of SB 149. This bill extends a tax credit that's part of a national model for consumer protection, and it's shared by nearly every state. It's a tried and true method with a track record of uninterrupted success in ensuring that individuals receive benefits that they pay for in their insurance policies. It's also an important part of a comprehensive insurance regulatory framework that minimizes the risk that the credit is ever even needed. State insurance regulators, including Oregon's Division of Financial Regulation, strictly regulate insurers, placing high barriers to operate in Oregon at all, requiring approval of policies before they can ever be sold, closely monitoring and regulating insurer solvency, and even having the right to take over insurance company operations if they become financially troubled. In the rare instances an insurer does become insolvent, all other insurers operating in Oregon have agreed to be assessed by the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association to make sure that policyholders receive the benefits they were promised in their policies up to statutory limits. In this rare instance, the offset becomes critical. It allows insurers to take a credit against those assessments over 5 years. This spreads the cost of an insolvency widely and ensures that the healthy insurers who step in to protect consumers when a competitor becomes insolvent do not themselves face financial instability. While the offset is vital, I want to emphasize again how rarely it is needed. I think just before LR voted, the last insolvency that resulted in a credit use was Penn Treaty, a Pennsylvania company. And, you know, they are very sporadic. I'm not sure when the last one was before that, but my understanding from the charts is it was quite a long time ago. So it's very possible that there's not a single assessment or any use of the credit at all over the next 6 years. This bill is an important safeguard. It's part of a comprehensive regulatory framework based on a national model that has a proven record of success in protecting consumers. And so for that, I'd urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next is Bennett Menton.
Madam's Chair and members of the Joint Committee. I'm Bennett Minton on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers who advocate for a rational and equitable tax code. We testified on the Senate bill, and we submitted testimony on the House companion. We do not wish to belabor the issue by repeating our points, urging sunset of this unique subsidy for the insurance industry. But I must note the rebuttal letter submitted by John Powell, representing two insurance companies and potential beneficiaries of the credit. It's included in the record of the Senate consideration. Mr. Powell takes issue with our comparison of the tax credit to FDIC deposit insurance, which is funded by member banks. We did not bring up the comparison to the FDIC. Advocates of the credit did. We noted that any comparison to FDIC insurance is inapt because that program is not funded by taxpayers. Mr. Powell contends that the tax credit is a subsidy for consumers. We don't disagree, except that, as we understand it, the insurance industry is required to support an insolvency fund. So the tax credit is a gift from taxpayers. In the end, of course, individuals pay all taxes, because, as presidential candidate Mitt Romney memorably pointed out, corporations are legal fictions. A quick response to Senator Riley. I'm no expert on the subsidy, but as I understand it, the subsidy has nothing to do with making policyholders whole. The committee has no jurisdiction over that program. It has jurisdiction over this one, which is a gift from the state. Again, as we asked before, we wonder what other industry selling a product in the free market receives a government subsidy in this fashion. No one seems to be able to cite one. That's why this credit should be allowed to die. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the testimony. And the last speaker will be John Mangan.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson and Co-Chair Burdick. For this opportunity. My name is John Mangan. I'm Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers. We're a national trade group that includes the Standard in Portland and 238 other companies licensed in Oregon, all of whom are members of the Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. You have a letter from me as part of the record, which I won't belabor, but I will just make 3 points and try to address a couple of the issues that just came up. We view this very much as a partnership. The association is a partnership between life and health companies between our regulators at the Division of Financial Regulation. We are a fully regulated industry. And of course, you at the legislature. The tax offset that was agreed to when this law was put in place is a key part of that partnership. That partnership has worked. And I'm proud to say that I was a part of that effort between 1993 and 2000, when I was actually chair of the association at Standard. It was a tumultuous time, and we had a huge insolvency, and we survived it, and the state system worked beautifully. And beginning in about 2000, you will see the LRO report accurately shows that the assessment cost went to virtual zero for almost, well, about 18 years, as Mr. Chifo said. So it definitely worked. Our solvency protection efforts at the division worked. Our efforts in the industry worked. Other states agree that it works, and you as a legislature have agreed in the past by extending this offset. Finally, I want to just say that as an industry, this is an offset that we don't want to use. It's rare because we work hard to make sure it's never used. And our regulators work hard to make sure that no company ever goes insolvent, because an insolvency hurts individuals potentially, and it certainly can hurt the state. And as Senator Riley knows, this coverage that is statutorily guaranteed has limits. Those limits can be raised by the legislature, and they have been raised over time, but they're statutory limits. And our agreement was we're going to cover those limits as best we can, and if we can go beyond that, we will. So the system has worked. And just on the issue of subsidy, I would just say we provide a lot of the subsidy until we get to this credit. We pay the entire cost of our regulation through assessments. We pay the entire cost of the Guarantee Association. We assess ourselves for all of its administrative costs, legal costs, and accounting costs. And of course, we pay the cost of the assessment when one of our competitors fails. And only after that assessment takes place and we keep policyholders as whole as possible, does the state come forward in partnership and say, okay, we'll do our part as well. And over a predictable 5-year period, a 5-year offset is allowed. Our companies still end up with a loss on that, but the state can manage that loss and that cost over 5 years, mitigate the cost to policy owners, and the system has worked, and we urge you to renew it once again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the testimony. One last confirmation from LRO that that is the end of the list. We had those two names added on most recently. There are no others after Mr. Mangan. Is that right?
Chair Nathanson, that is correct.
Thank you for confirming that. Is there anyone from DCBS who can very briefly respond to the inquiry from Senator Riley? And if you don't have the information tonight, you could submit it to the committee in writing.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. So briefly, I'm going to try to explain it, and we'll turn it over to Greg Lathrop here briefly in a second just to confirm my understanding. The two items are somewhat disconnected in that there are statutory limits when a carrier goes insolvent as far as what the Guarantee Association will pay for the policies that are part of the carrier that went insolvent book of business. Then the assessment to the carriers in support of the guarantee fund for that insolvency are only up to the statutory limits. And so there's a corresponding assessment and then a corresponding tax credit, presumably, that would be given based on the insolvency, but it never goes beyond the statutory limits. And I'll look to Greg Lathrop to correct anything I said there.
This is Greg Lathrop. I have no corrections. He's very accurate.
Okay, thank you both for that response. Looking at the time, I'm hoping to move on to the rest of the public hearings for tonight. Senator Riley, would you like to add something before we close this public hearing?
Yes, thank you. I agree with what their explanation is. That's not the issue. The issue is that one of the last testifiers said that they do the mandatory minimum and more if they can. I have never seen them do more. So I think that's probably incorrect. And the amount that is authorized is nowhere near what most policyholders would have in claims if they had a claim, a valid claim, and the company that they held a policy with went insolvent. And that's really what I was getting at. And I see Mr. Keene is nodding his head. So, but yes, their explanation was the way I understand it as well.
Thank you. That concludes our work on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 149. Next, I'm moving to open a public hearing on House Bill 2442A and Senate Bill 144, Taxpayer with Severe Disability.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2442A and Senate Bill 144 will sound somewhat similar to the very first credit extension you heard at the start of the public hearing today. But in this case, this credit is once again providing an additional personal exemption credit. So that amount would be about $214 in tax year 2021. But in this case, the first one we heard about was a taxpayer with a child with a disability. In this case, the credit here is for the taxpayer with a severe disability. So a taxpayer that qualifies for that severe disability or the taxpayer spouse can qualify for that additional personal exemption credit, which again, this is indexed to inflation. Most recently in tax year 2021, it'd be about $214. And then one of the changes made a few years ago, beginning with tax year 2016, was means testing this credit. So that was making this credit only available to those taxpayers with an adjusted gross income less than $100,000. We've seen about 32,000 taxpayers have used this credit per year with an average credit amount about $145. And we're expecting costs to be about $5 million per year in years going forward.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for Mr. Easton? And while I wait a few seconds to see if there are questions, I want to confirm with LRO that we do not have any witnesses signed up for either of these bills. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, that is correct.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any questions, so I'll wait just a few more seconds. Okay, that completes the work on those two bills. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2442A and Senate Bill 144. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2452 and Senate Bill 150.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2452 and Senate Bill 150 is the extension for a credit for physicians providing care in one of Oregon's two veterans' homes. So again, this is a credit, and it's a six-year extension, a credit that's available to physicians who are providing care, again, in one of Oregon's two veterans' homes. In this case, the credit is equal to $1,000 for every eight residents to whom the physician provides care, up to $5,000. There are requirements a physician cannot miss more than 5% of scheduled visits, and they are required to obtain a letter of verification from the Oregon Veterans Home as well, confirming that they did not miss more than 5% of those scheduled visits. One note on this credit, the amount again can be $1,000, but up to $5,000. A taxpayer who qualifies for this credit is able to claim this credit and also the rural medical credit that you heard about earlier in the public hearing as well. Again, this credit has been used or is used rather sparingly. There's about 15 taxpayers per year that are claiming this credit. Averages about $1,800 per taxpayer, and for that reason, we generally consider this to have a cost to extend of less than $100,000 or a minimal amount going forward.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Easton? And while we wait for a hand to go up, if there is a question, I want to confirm with Legislative Revenue Office, I have no witnesses signed up for either of these two bills. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, that is correct.
Thank you. I don't see any questions for Mr. Easton. I think we're done with our work on these two bills. All right, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2452 and Senate Bill 150. Our last bills. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2440 and Senate Bill 146.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2440 and Senate Bill 146 is extending the tax credit for the working family household dependent care credit. There is, again, some material in OLIS related to this credit. I know we're nearly out of time here, so I won't bring up any slides for you right now, but I would draw your attention. There's both the presentation and there's also some background material from the tax credit report. But again, what the working family household independent care credit is this is a refundable income tax credit. It's generally designed to benefit low and middle income households that have employment related daycare expenses. So what that means is probably the primary example would be a taxpayer that has childcare expenses. And so what the credit does is it helps to offset some of those costs incurred by the taxpayer for those childcare costs. It's also available to taxpayers that have a disabled spouse and costs associated with that as well, that this credit could qualify them for. But just in general, the way this credit is designed, again, it's a refundable income tax credit, and it's designed to help cover those costs. So again, using that childcare cost example, the credit is a credit percentage of those costs, and that credit percentage initially starts lower, increases as a taxpayer's income as a percentage of federal poverty level increases, and then it plateaus for a bit, and then the credit phases back out. And the idea there is the credit provides more offset of these costs as the taxpayer earns more money, and then as the taxpayer continues to earn more income, the credit amount will then begin to phase back out. So it's somewhat similar, although the amounts aren't the same, somewhat similar in terms of how the earned income tax credit works, in that it moves up, plateaus, then moves back down as income increases. But again, it's just a six-year extension of the working family household dependent care credit.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Easton? Legislative Revenue Office, we have no one signed up to testify for these bills. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, that is correct.
Okay. That's the last time I'm going to ask you about it tonight. Thank you for being on top of it for us. Any questions? I'm not seeing any hands yet. Representative Rushke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Easton, how many people a year take advantage of this? Maybe you covered that and I missed it. I had notes of somewhere like 28,000 people take advantage of this. And again, my question would be the number and whether that number is increasing or decreasing over time, or what your estimate of the population taking advantage of this would be.
Yeah, Representative Reschke, so in the slides, on slide 8, there is a listing of the number of taxpayers, and I'll just read right from that. But it's about, you're correct, it's about 28,000 of our full-year filers that are claiming this credit. The average amount is about $1,100. Again, that can vary, and again, that's reflective of how the credit changes as income changes. We do see the average amount of the credit go up initially, and then starts to, you can see it phasing out as income increases. In terms of looking forward, This credit came about if two credits were combined. So this credit has only been around for a few years now. So we only have a few years worth of data, and it's been pretty flat in terms of use of this. And we've had, that's what we have in what Chris started this meeting with in terms of the cost to extend, is we do expect this to be relatively flat. There are a lot of things that, or other things that can influence this credit as well. This credit is for costs that are incurred by the taxpayer. So one of the things of note is the legislature is talking about the employment-related daycare program, which is a direct spending subsidy program. And so changes to the ERDC program, increasing that direct subsidy spending, can then influence this credit in that it lessens the cost of this credit, because that's more of a subsidy for the taxpayer that's purchasing, say, that child care. So that's less cost directly to the taxpayer. And again, it's those direct costs of the taxpayer they can use to claim this credit, which is probably a very long answer to say we expect it to be relatively flat in the out years.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Looks like we're done with those two bills. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2440 and Senate Bill 146. That completes our public hearings scheduled for tonight. We're at 7 o'clock, but before we adjourn, Mr. Allenack, could you please tell us what other information you've prepared for us, what's available for the committee related to the materials you were talking about at the beginning of the meeting?
Sure, Madam Chair. So the document that you are referring to, EDOLIS, is the TE budget and ARPA restrictions. And I went through the main few slides, but at the back end of that, there are a couple more pages that are in response to a question last week. And the question had to do with the up and down nature of the income tax collections, and that being determined by the kicker, really kind of pushing that up and down. It was kind of a jagged forecast. And I put together a few slides that walked through explaining how the kicker affects the forecast. So those slides are back there, and I'm not sure if it's self-explanatory, but members at their leisure can take a look at that. And if you have any questions, let me know. It basically just takes the current forecast and then kind of takes out the kicker and shows you what the forecast would look like if we did not have the kicker. And then you get to the smooth trend that you would expect to see.
Thank you. So look for those materials. Before I adjourn for the night, Co-Chair Burdick, is there anything you would like to mention for us or for your committee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We will be meeting again tomorrow. We have a kind of an unusual schedule with this committee. We'll be meeting tomorrow from 3:15 to 5, is that correct, Chris? And we'll be discussing for part of the meeting, we will be discussing work that Senator Boquist and I have been working on, reforming the pass-through tax system that we have. And I wanted to give both revenue committees a preview of that before we start hearings next week, since we're reaching the closing days of the session. And then we will be talking about other tax credits tomorrow. And Chris, do you want to elaborate just a little bit on the other agenda items tomorrow?
Sure, Madam Chair. The other tax credits that you'll be hearing tomorrow, there are basically three of them, two housing and a film and video credit. And those are existing tax credits. So those are some modifications to existing tax credits, which is the theme.
Right. And in the case of the housing tax credit and the film credit, it'll be a matter of getting a little bit more of an extension on the sunset because of the needs for these two areas to have advanced planning. So we will see you tomorrow at 3:15.
Great, thank you. And if there, if we conclude our work tomorrow with any minutes left over, maybe there would be time for the committee if they have reviewed the additional information that Mr. Allenack just told us about. If you have any questions about that material, we might have time to get to it tomorrow. If not, then we'll do it at a future meeting. Anything else from the committee before we adjourn? Thank you all. See you tomorrow. We're adjourned.